Wednesday night edition of the pod, and we got a lot to talk about here, to be sure. And I think, of course, we're going to have to start with this crazy Sixers story. Read the entire article for sure on The Ringer. Ben Dietrich, amazing job with this story. But essentially, I don't even want to say allegation because they don't specifically take a position on whether, in fact, it was Brian Colangelo with these accounts or not. But Colangelo, there's evidence indicating that he operated 5 anonymous Twitter accounts. These Twitter accounts tweeted stuff that, if it were proven to be Colangelo, would certainly be grounds for firing. I think there'd be clearly no way that you could ever come back to that stuff about Joel Embiid, how they should just milk him because he's not the future of the franchise and it's Ben Simmons and all this inflammatory stuff about Jahlil Okafor and his physical and Nerlens Noel being a cancer and just an incredible amount of stuff here that there's just no way that if a GM were found to have made those public statements that he could hold on to his job. So I think probably the place to start here, Danny, is, you know, what is the evidence that indicating that this was in fact Colangelo? And again, I'd recommend that you guys listen to the podcast that Ben Dietrich did today on the Ringer NBA show, that Derek Bodner and Rich Hoffman did a great job on the Sixers beat talking about this today too. But just because, you know, this is a national NBA show, and we feel the need to kind of just bring you up to date here, what is the evidence indicating that this is in fact Brian Colangelo?
Well, so there are a series of kind of interesting connections in the way that Dietrich researched this story that make it a lot more compelling to me. And so what happened is it really relates to these 5 Twitter accounts. And what happened was there were some commonalities in terms of what certain accounts followed and people that had looking like they had connections to Colangelo, and like it was an unusual cross section of things is a good way of putting it. And so the first thing that struck me as like, oh, this is really interesting, was early on Dietrich, but not early on, I think it's on May 22nd, he emailed the Sixers and brought up 2 of those accounts. One of which ended up being the one that they eventually admitted Brian Colangelo does run. That account, to be specific, never tweeted at all. And so it was not involved in this behavior, but again, was a part of the process. And it followed a lot of things. Colangelo admitted to it. It was a way of monitoring whatever. That part of it is there. But so what's really interesting is he mentioned that account, and the what's called the Eric Jr. account did not mention anything about the other 3 that they suspected were involved in it. And yet, later that same day, within hours of the call, all 3 of the accounts that had not been mentioned were moved from being public to being private, which involves access to the tweets. And that, to me, is very interesting. That does not necessarily mean that it was Colangelo, but I think that means that it was somewhere within the sphere, because I doubt from the Ringer's standpoint, you know, from Dietrich's standpoint, that he spread the net anywhere beyond it. And so it was just whatever circle learned of that, of those 2 and had that connection. And that's the first thing that I'm like, huh, this might be a bigger thing than I originally thought it might be.
And that is probably the most damning evidence that these were, if not Colangelo, someone very closely associated with either him or the team. I think the only way that would not be the case is and Colangelo has said basically, someone is trying to set me up. He has now actually texted that to Jordan Schultz, which it doesn't seem like a great idea to me, that you would probably want to just have one coordinated response and voice here. I don't know why you would just send like one short text to a media member, just along something like that. But in any event, that apparently is Colangelo's position now, that he's being set up. But the only way that would dovetail with this idea of those Twitter accounts being deactivated on the same day that the Sixers were told, because that just seems like too extreme of a coincidence, would be if perhaps Dietrich was in communication with this anonymous source who initially told him essentially, like, I think that Colangelo is running these accounts back in February. If Dietrich spilled the beans on his little trick, which I thought was pretty smart, actually, of telling the Sixers about it and monitoring the other 3 accounts, and then that whoever it was who's operating those accounts found out from Dietrich's side rather than the Sixers' side that there had been information given to the Sixers and their shutdown. That seems unlikely to me. I think Dietrich would probably be smarter than it, to let the source know that he was doing that.
Right. And then the other part that gets complicated with this is, and this I think is the most concerning element, not as much for me the criticism of the players, though I don't love that, is the potential release of secret information through
Twitter.
Well,
and that's what's so damning about this, too. I mean, that's probably the second most damning piece of evidence, other than the one we just talked about, the accounts being shut down, is the fact that there was this apparent level of knowledge that, and, you know, guys like Bodner have said, hey, you know, we're around the team. We didn't report a lot of this stuff, but we'd had other information indicating it was true. Like, that level of knowledge is another thing that would indicate that if it's not Colangelo, it's certainly someone around the team who knows this stuff.
Right. And so there is certainly a subsection of people that would have the requisite information, but it's hard to see somebody who can check all of the boxes. You know, maybe, and this is just speculation, but, you know, like maybe a family member, depending on what kind of relationship they have there. I mean, that's, you know, sometimes people talk about their work in that sort of a circumstance. Maybe, but it's a small circle to be sure. And it's concerning. And then the other big part of this that I think is worth, you know, kind of getting at in the early section here is the element of trust. And I just was thinking about this because I was writing the and just published the OKC offseason preview for The Athletic. And what I wrote about in that was in relation to Paul George, it doesn't necessarily matter what the reality of OKC's season was, whether, you know, Roberson being out really sabotaged their season. And if he had been there the whole year, they would have been a championship contender, because at a specific juncture, all that is relevant is what the parties involved feel. And that's where this gets really complicated, because, yeah, theoretically, there could be some sort of mass exoneration. It could be something that shows, okay, maybe this account was Colangelo, but then the other ones were not, and he was trying to be set up, something like that. But not only for Joel Embiid, Markel Fultz, those players, but also the Sixers have max cap space. They have all these things going on. And so even if it ends up being unfair, we're a month away from free agency. That perception could really matter.
Oh, yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about that, too. I mean, if we kind of, after we kind of wrap up the idea of like whether it actually is him or not. So let me ask you this. What are the most plausible explanations for this? Let's rank them. Give us our top three most plausible explanation for this story. Number one for me is that it's him. Would that be your number one?
My number one would be that maybe not all of them are him, but that they're people closely enough affiliated where it's functionally, you know, not that different. Like, it could be a family member, something like that. I would have that as number one, and then all being him, number two.
Okay, so the family member thing, what about the fact that, you know, these accounts are following all these people who are specific to him? So are you saying that if it's a family member, that family member decided to mirror who Colangelo's account was following, and that, you know, would Brian even say, oh yeah, by the way, you know, the Phila 1-7 account that I use, that's actually me. So maybe you would say that's me. You know, I followed you with that, you know, my son or whatever, I followed you for University of Chicago basketball, though there's indications that it wouldn't be his son because some of the tweets were sent when he was actually playing in games. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't really, if it's just some family member, it doesn't make sense that they would be following all of these exact same accounts. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, well, maybe that was just my interpretation. I didn't know that all three, like, it's those three accounts, I think, primarily, that I didn't realize, maybe that was just my misinterpretation, that all three of them basically follow the same people.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it is all the same. I mean, the implication was that there were, of the story, is that there was significant overlap with a lot of these. And then also,
And then the recovery number and all that.
Yeah, and also with the, you know, the verbiage that was used is very similar across all the accounts as well. So I think it's more likely than not that it was him. I don't know that to be true. I can't prove that. But so number two would have to be someone close to him, family member, or maybe someone else in the Sixers organization. And then number three is, you know, that this was some kind of intentional long con setup that, you know, let's keep in mind, these accounts were tweeting back from like 2016. So like, this would be like a 2-year con job. And then that person got in touch with Ben Dietrich in February and set up. I do the identity of this source. You know, I'm not sure that this, like, oh, you know, I was just an AI and I, you know, care about the Sixers and just happen to notice this. Like, you know, that does seem a little fishy. You know, that's probably the fishiest thing that you could point to make it say, okay, maybe it is a setup, because it's not necessarily something that holds water. Like, oh yeah, you know, I just decided to do this analysis and it just turns out that this person seems like it would be Colangelo. And like, that's how the anonymous source got to that point. If the anonymous source weren't somehow involved and close to the situation, you know, that strikes me as a little bit less likely. But and believe me, I'm not saying like, oh yeah, it's obviously him, you know, they should fire him. Well, I think they probably should fire him. We'll get to that part too. But regardless of whether it was him or not, it frankly, because deserve ain't got nothing to do with it. But, you know, I'm not saying that it's like impossible that it's not him. You know, I think, but I do think that is the most likely explanation at this point. Are there any other possibilities for how this could have come about that we haven't talked about in those three kind of general scenarios?
Not that I can really think about. I mean, I guess maybe it could be a column of, like, it could be partially some and partially another, but that seems weird given the, you know, saying the word and all of, and two of the other three getting taken down. Like, that makes me think that it's more within one net rather than being like a mix of column A and column B, let's say.
The other thing too is I have to admit, and other people have talked to a lot more people around the league than I have about this, have kind of said the same thing. It's like, this story is certainly surprising, but it's not that surprising. Like, if you had to say, all right, this story happened, pick an NBA GM who did this, Brian Colangelo would be at the top, if not at the absolute top of this list. He definitely is known for having rabbit ears. That is even more pronounced now that he's in Philadelphia and he's succeeding Sam Hinkie, who was a darling of at least a subset of the fans and media that covered the team. And just, you know, their general ineptitude from a PR standpoint, and the way that PR has both been completely ineffective at times and also indicative of a desperation to try to control the message at the same time as being ineffective. You know, that very much dovetails with this. And for all those who say, all right, it can't be him, you know, it would just be too stupid, it's too crazy, I'm not going to go at the, oh, it's 2018, look at all the crazy shit, like this, nothing is too crazy for 2018. I think that's just, you know, that's a little bit too nonspecific for my taste. But certainly we have seen that a characteristic of the social media era is a desire to defend oneself and just to get all of this criticism and have a way to respond, even if you know intellectually, all right, this probably isn't going to change things that much. But just to, like, there is a feeling that people have it. I mean, and I have experienced this many a time when I get criticized on social media, and there are times I wish I could have done a better job of just not responding. But there is a very human desire when you believe that people are misunderstanding things or the narrative is going against you to want to respond. And, you know, whether this Twitter account with 25 followers or whatever tweeting at media people, whether he rationally thought that would actually have any difference. If you say, hey, ask Jahlil Okafor whether he failed this physical on the trade or not, whether he thought that was actually going to make a Sixers reporter do that, or whether it was just cathartic to be able to do that, I don't know. But there certainly is a feeling and that we've seen borne out with a lot of public figures of wanting to respond to these sort of allegations, or I shouldn't say allegations, but just narratives that go against them publicly.
Along those same lines, for in the modern era of social media, this must be a very hard time for those who had rabbit ears even before this, because there are just so many voices out there. And one of the challenges, I mean, you and I are much less public figures than an NBA general manager, that you have to deal with is that there are people who dislike you, there are people who dislike your work, and it is much easier for them to get a platform that could even theoretically reach you than was possible before. They don't have to take the time to email you or, you know, anything like that. It can be, you know, just saying something on Twitter. It can be something very easy like that. And so if you are attuned to that and that matters to you, it's very easy for that noise to feel loud. And then you remember what Sixers Twitter is like and the feeling of support for Hinkie, and so, and in my opinion, justifiably so, because I think Hinkie did a very good job. We've talked about that a lot on the show. So I can see how someone would not only perceive that genuine frustration as being large, but also want to do feel like they owe it to themselves, or just that they should stem the tide if they can. And I am sympathetic for it. I do not engage with those trolls. I understand that they exist and all that, but for my own purposes. But I understand that is very unusual, and it takes self-control and restraint for me to do that. It's not what I want to do. It's what I think is best overall.
And this isn't an unprecedented story either. Kevin Arnovitz related a story on the Low Post today about how there was a Clippers staffer who clearly was a commenter on Clipper blog, and then...
There's the Warriors one too.
Yes. Is that public? I forget.
I believe so.
But anyway, it's there are certainly at least two incidents that I know of NBA staffers using anonymous accounts back in more the internet message board days to try to influence things a little bit. And it's just, you know, again, like there's no point to it. Like, you're not going to change the way people think about it necessarily. All right, let's do a read. We got more to talk about on this, though. Right after this, from Sonos, I've really been enjoying a number of aspects of my Sonos. One is just the voice control, especially when you're in a situation socially where you don't want to just like be buried in your phone and try to put up a playlist or something. You can just do quickly voice control, play an artist, connect your Spotify to it, and now you've got some great background music for your social gathering. The other thing I've just been so impressed by with them is the incredible sound quality. I think a big part of why that is that actually when they come up and set it up with your up and running service, they actually take an iPhone around the room. The Sonos will emit a series of pulses. The iPhone listens to those pulses and how it sounds in various parts of the room. And then the Sonos can actually optimize the sound to your specific room. We have a kind of an acoustically difficult house, and a lot of the rooms are different. You can really tell the difference before and after they did that treatment. We've been watching a lot of Star Trek The Next Generation at home. That opening theme song sounds amazing on the Sonos setup. And while they are really easy to set up, this up and running service that they have will do it for free if you live in any major metropolitan area. They will have a trained expert deliver and set up your system absolutely free. If you go to Sonos.com, all you have to do is select up and running at checkout if you qualify. Right now, Sonos is offering our listeners 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com. This offer is available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. Got to make sure to let you know that. But the promo code here is going to be a little bit different than the usual code. It's DUNC10, D-U-N-C-10, D-U-N-C-1-0 at Sonos.com. Enter that DUNC10 code to receive that offer of 10% off one order of $2,500 or less at Sonos.com. Let us know if you like the product. Actually, I always appreciate those tweets. If you buy something in it and you like it, a lot of times we'll use those in the next ad. But use that promo code DUNC10 to let them know that you came from us. So here's my next question. What would it take to prove to you that Brian Colangelo was not somehow culpable, whether it was through him or a family member or someone close to him on the Sixers staff? What would it take to convince you that there's no culpability here?
I think it would take a direct thread, like a direct proven thread to something else. Like, for example, if the recovery email on that account, like on one of the accounts that actually tweeted, was to something that we knew he didn't control, ideally if we knew who did it, like that sort of a thing.
How are you going to prove that, unless someone admits to it, how are you going to prove that he didn't control that?
Well, I mean, that's what it would be if it was, you know, whatever that email could be. Maybe other people have dealt with that account. You know, it would be very hard to do. Theoretically, I guess the easiest way for me to believe that somebody else did it is if somebody else admits to it. But I don't necessarily expect that, especially if this was a long con. I would guess that person would do enough to cover their tracks for long enough to make this like just kind of stay around. You know, that's the person who would probably be more diligent about it rather than, you know, somebody who kind of got caught in this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be difficult to get definitive proof that it was him. But I think it's also very difficult to get definitive proof that it wasn't him. So, I mean, what could he do? Maybe he could say, all right, here's every device that I have used, laptop, phone, iPad, whatever, over the last 3 years. I'm going to hand this over to some sort of forensic investigator, and that person is going to go through all these devices and conclude that I never logged into any of these Twitter accounts or never did any of these tweets. Now, that's an indication that it wasn't him, but there's still, you know, maybe there was some other phone involved. Maybe you went to Maxi Mart and got a burner phone or something. Like, you know, there's still, that's not definitive proof. It might help you a little bit. Maybe if there were some sort of like situation where he had to be under oath and testify about this under penalty of perjury. I'm not even sure what that could be. You know, that's another thing. You know, people lie under oath all the time, of course, but that at least could be someone helpful. Someone else coming forward and saying, yes, this was me. You know, that might do it. If that were in fact convincing and that person had some sort of proof that it was actually him, maybe that could get you there. But, you know, anything else that they could do to prove that it wasn't him?
Not that I can think of. And just in the ways that people can cover their tracks on the internet, I'm guessing forensic people can do a better job of it. And also there's the question of what information of that can be made public. Like, for example, you know, like I know that they can log information in terms of where an account, like the IP addresses and all that. But I don't know that Twitter would make that information available to any private party that is trying to prove that it's not them. Like that, yeah. You would go down a real slippery slope if that's what you're trying to do. If you're trying to prove that it is you, yeah, maybe in a specific circumstance that could actually work. But I mean, yeah, that would bring about a bunch of dangerous
stuff. As I understand it, the only ones who are going to, at least in any kind of near term, who would have access to the account information there are the account owners. And, you know, maybe if some sort of legal proceeding were initiated and there were a subpoena to Twitter, there'd be a way to get that user information. I'm sure that would be a big battle. Twitter's probably not very interested in setting a precedent where you can get that information from them. But now let's just get to the realities of the situation. I mean, this is all forensic investigators and reports, and the Sixers are doing an investigation and all that. That's all well and good. They got a draft coming up. They got the biggest free agent summer probably in the team's history coming up here. So whatever conclusions are going to be found here, whatever investigation is being done, I highly doubt, A, that investigation could be completed before, you know, in less than a month and a half here. Number two, that any such investigation could reach a definitive conclusion as of that point. And so given all that, if you were Sixers owner Josh Harris, what would you do right now? What would your reaction to this be right now?
Well, I would definitely want to talk with the players that are still on the team that could be affected by this. And I will note that my interpretation of the Jahlil Okafor workhorse one was actually that it was sarcastic, but I'm not entirely
Jahlil
sure.
Okafor,
and there are a lot of other,
one?
You know, sorry, the Joel Embiid one.
Oh, when he's like, yeah,
oh, we can
let's just run him into the ground because he's going to be a part
yeah.
of the team's
for,
future.
For another reason why it's bad to use sarcasm on in text-based form, unless it's so obvious or somebody knows your context. Anyway, let's get back to it. So I would talk to those types of players because that their opinion is important here.
Well, Joel already tweeted, if this is true, it's really bad. You know, and I think he right. kind of, reading between the lines, I'm just guessing here, that initial tweet, which was absolutely hilarious, by the way, in which he said, Sam Hinkie is smarter than you, and he used he added the burner account with that. But then he had a statement to Woj. I'm sure someone got to him and said, like, all right, Joel, you got to just, like, stop going off here and be a little more measured. So he talked to Woj and was like, yeah, you know what? Like, I'll got to take him at his word that it's not true for now. But if it is true, that it'd be bad. But, I mean, number one, the players, that's a major issue. But, you know, just number two, being able to deal with other teams is huge. The free agent aspect, of course, too. I mean, that's probably even the biggest part of this. So just, you know, LeBron James, are you going to try and trade for Kawhi Leonard? You're trying to get Paul George or, you know, whatever they're going to do with that 27 to maybe even more million in cap space. Also, just whether even you're willing to have someone who's clearly this unhinged continue to be involved in your organization, whether it's true or not. But ultimately, I think what I would do is treat it similar to like the Danny Ferry situation after he made those racially inflammatory comments about Luol Deng. All right, we're going to put you on administrative leave until this investigation is complete, and probably you're just going to have to go off into the sunset here, because let's just put it from this perspective, right? Even if this is totally untrue, this is always going to be a massive stain on Colangelo's career. There's always going to be a lot of questions about it. As we said, I'm not sure what proof you could eventually come up with, especially if it hasn't become, if it hasn't come forward by now, right? Like, they've known about this for over a week now, and they haven't come up with an explanation such as, you know, it was a family member or something like that, right? It's just Colangelo doesn't know what's going on. No one with the Sixers seems to know what's going on. If they don't know now, the only way they're going to find out is through some sort of really long, lengthy investigation, and then maybe they're never going to find out. So with all that being the case, I think you got to get him out of the picture as soon as possible here, because just the downside of leaving him in, you know, don't fire him because, you know, you don't know whether this is true or not, but the downside of leaving him in there now is just so much greater than the upside. I mean, is Brian Colangelo is just such a genius that having him instead of someone else running things is like going to be so much value added that it outweighs the negatives? I don't think so.
Well, and we haven't talked enough about the other just massive complication here, which is that his father is an important part of this organization as well. And to me, the decision on what to do with Brian Colangelo is a Josh Harris decision, even if, and I mean, especially considering his dad and everything like that. But that makes all this more complicated. And what role does the family connection play in all this? It's just Jerry's part is going to be fascinating here too.
Yeah, Jerry is a special advisor to the managing partner, as of now, as he's listed on the Sixers masthead. Potential temporary replacements. There are not really anyone who is experienced at the GM type level. Mark Eversley was just relatively, he's really number two on their masthead. He's relatively recently elevated. He's more of a scouting guy. Ned Cohen is kind of more of a cap administrative guy than as much of a basketball guy. A lot of people obviously left when Hinkie left. They've got Alex Rucker, who is their director of analytics and oversees this enormous, you know, $3 million per season analytics operation that was given a hagiography in the Philly papers a couple months ago. But, you know, I'm not sure that there's anyone that pops out as like, all right, this guy is like clear GM material. But, you know, I still would rather have Mark Eversley making the decisions. Maybe you can kind of bring in an experienced hand as a consultant really quickly. But I don't see how you can continue to leave Colangelo in there. I think you have to put him on administrative leave now pending the results list, because it's not going to get any better. And it's just such a distraction too, having him around, having to deal with all this stuff instead of actually doing your jobs. You know, I'm usually not one to talk about distractions, but when it gets to the heart of the relationships and that are involved and the trustworthiness of the individual involved and people having to deal with him, and there has to be a lot of trust to get any kind of an NBA transaction done, whether it's a free agent transaction, a trade, a draft pick, I don't see how you can have him running things for the next month or two. And the downside of that is so much greater than the downside of just, you know, taking him out of things for a month or two. And you know what? He can continue to just kind of, you know, as long as he's not the one making the calls, maybe he can still kind of be around and have some conversations with the guys or whatever. And hey, what do you think of this?
Well, and he had a hand in picking everybody else on the staff.
Right.
So you can, you know, it's kind of like when a coach has to take a leave of absence, you still see their impact on the process, even if they're not making those kind of minutia decisions. Oh, so just for my own amusement and because I saw it on Twitter and I'm just like, oh God, that would be so perfect. Is I don't think David Griffin would be interested in that kind of consultant role, but considering who one of the free agents is and the acrimony with which LeBron responded to David Griffin's ouster, that would be pretty amazing. I also think that if Colangelo has to be fired, Griffin's professionalism and relationships around the league would actually make him a very natural
He's also pretty experienced at dealing with like completely ridiculous PR crises.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, I mean, I think the biggest part of this that everybody needs to get a sense of is the timing. The timing here is just absolutely brutal. Draft is in a couple weeks, free agency is in a month, but the research that goes into that, the conversations with agents, that it didn't just start now, it started months ago. And everything that happens from here is incredibly challenging, and the stakes are insanely high. So that's why this matters so much. That's why we spent more than a half hour on this, is because it's important.
Yeah, and again, yeah.
Oh, and also, and also, the Sixers extended Brett Brown another 3 years.
Yeah, it was posited that was like something to try to distract from this. Ah, no, I don't think it did. So, and my prediction for what happens here is that it will be a Danny Ferry administrative leave type of thing. I don't know about them bringing in another more experienced guy as a consultant necessarily, but I think it has to end this way, especially as we go further and further and there's no clearly exculpatory evidence, and just in the difficulty of finding that exculpatory evidence as well. I mean, really the only way that he could even get his job kind of back would be if it is somehow proven that this was just this long con, like 2 years long thing that someone was trying, even if it's someone close to him. I think there's just no way to get past it, especially because, you know, that now, if it were someone close to him, you would think that would have come out already by now, but it, for whatever reason, it hasn't. Is that your prediction as well, or do you think it ends up differently than the way I do?
I think that's where it ends up, but I'm not sure that it goes there right away. I think that could end up being this, if it takes another week or so for that to happen.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I think that would be a reasonable time frame. Any longer than that, though, I would be surprised.
If it's 2 weeks, then it's, yeah, I mean, as we get close to the draft. And remember, the Sixers have the 10 pick. This isn't a year where just because they were so good, they're only picking in the 20s. No, they have the number 10 pick in the draft. This matters.
Man, how hilarious would it be if, like, those accounts, like, started tweeting again? That would be, that would be pretty funny. Yeah, I mean, the utter hilarity of this situation is pretty good. Although, you know, I will say that while Colangelo's is not my favorite, and the circumstances in which he got the job is not my favorite, if this were for some reason a setup, I would feel extremely bad for him. But
yeah,
and I do think the hilarity of, oh wow, Sam Hinkie is embarrassing the organization, we got to get rid of him. Well. You know, I think they might wish to have Sam Hinkie back right about now. All right, should we talk a little Boston Celtics offseason here?
Well, I'll give you the choice. Do you want to do a little bit of news? Because we have.
Oh, yeah. Let's do that. That's a good idea. And then we could do a read before Celtics.
Yeah. So I would say the biggest piece of news outside of that is Orlando hired a head coach. They hired Steve Clifford. It is reported by Woj as a 4-year deal, which is what you would expect in the circumstance. We don't really have any more nuance than that. And Clifford, it's notable, has connections to both the Orlando Magic as a franchise because he was an assistant under Stan Van Gundy, and to the front office because he interviewed for the Bucks job when he ended up taking the Hornets job. So there was some familiarity because the Bucks personnel, you know, they're the Bucks front office people then are the Magic front office people now. And you and I talked about it when Clifford was fired in Charlotte, that we hoped he would get another job. I think he's a good coach. And we would get clarification in terms of what parts of Steve Clifford's MO, as we know it, you know, low turnovers, traditional centers, what parts of that are just inexorably part of Steve Clifford as a head coach and which parts are not, because the Orlando Magic have a lot of uncertain pieces, particularly in the front court.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see if he can get some more out of Nikola Vucevic, in particular defensively. And this is a guy who, granted, in a different league, but actually crafted decent enough defenses around Al Jefferson, so really similarly offensively tilted big man with slow feet. So yeah, well, I want to see if he can be successful. He's probably the best experienced coach on the market. There had been talk, I think it was from Mark Stein, that Kelvin Sampson was featured prominently in the process, but this seems like kind of a good compromise because of his Orlando connections. We know certainly that ownership, that CEO Alex Martins, have been very active in coaching searches before, in particular with Scott Skiles, but then also, as you mentioned, there are a few connections to Milwaukee. So that 4-year deal, relatively typical. You know, it's probably a 4-1, meaning that there's a team option on the end. That's kind of just what these coaches are, unless it's just a real premium candidate, which Clifford is not. So that leaves us with Detroit still open.
Detroit and Toronto, right.
And there's in Detroit, this weird situation where they brought in Ed Stefanski. I'm not sure what it was about Ed Stefanski's resume that made them think that he should be some consultant. And now Stefanski is bringing in who? Bernie Bickerstaff and Jim Lynham to, you know, not exactly the cutting edge of NBA coaches and executives necessarily. You know, these are guys who were cut their teeth in the 90s and have not really been, you know, I think Bickerstaff has been a scout recently. Lynham, I want to say, has been doing like Philly TV. So that this is going to be, all three of these guys now are consulting on who the new coach is going to be. And they're going to, the first reported interview that they're going to have is Kenny Smith. So that doesn't bode too well so far. We'll see. Maybe they'll try a little better. But certainly Smith's TV persona Well, he's certainly the adult in the room from a strategic standpoint compared to Barkley and Shaq on that show. I still have not been particularly impressed with his strategic chops, so be interesting to see where that ends up.
Well, and remember that the Detroit coaching job is a very challenging one tactically because they have so much tied up in their two big men in Blake Griffin and Andre Drummond. Griffin has been a better jump shooter recently, and those guys both want the ball a lot, but then you have a point guard like that. That's a hard job. And they have some time pressure because of the money they have tied up and everybody else. So I think you want to get somebody that hits the ground running rather than somebody who has never been a head coach at any level. Though head coaches from any level jumping from TV have had a mixed success rate, oftentimes with the Golden State Warriors because they did it twice with their two most recent jobs.
What else we got here?
This happened a little while back, but Doc Rivers got an extension. We don't have the exact terms of that, but I think that is a small piece of information that would lead some to believe that the Clippers will not go through a full teardown in the immediate. There were other reasons for that. I mean, they still have Danilo Gallinari under contract. I just think Doc Rivers wouldn't sign up for that because he could be interested in a lot of other
jobs. Yeah, I'm not sure if he had any other options, though, at this point, though. That would have been better, even if they are going to do a little bit of a rebuild potentially. But I think more that they're trying for the 2019 cap space. You know, maybe they take
I think that would be smart for them if they do that. So we'll see with that. You can't really read too much into it. The one that surprised me, and it might just be that I missed something. Andre Roberson underwent a knee scope on Tuesday, May 29th, so a couple days ago, and it was elective to proactively relieve synovitis, and they expect that he will be back. You know, he's on pace to be back for the beginning of the season, but, you know, after the other issue that he went through, I was a little bit surprised that this kind of came out of nowhere.
I mean, it sounds like he had been developing some swelling in the course of his rehab from that torn patellar tendon, and the party line is, well, better to have this surgery now so that if it doesn't resolve, I mean, and swelling is so difficult, right? Like, sometimes you can just build up and then your knee is strong enough and it won't swell anymore. But I guess the thinking was, hey, it's going to be rehabbing still anyway. Better to just have this surgery now, continue the rehab, try to be ready for training camp, as opposed to now you're maybe this will go away, but it's going to complicate your rehab. And then if it doesn't go away, now you got to have the surgery again at the start of training camp. So this, I think a lot of this has to do with the timing, but not a great sign, especially in torn patellar tendon, not quite the death knell that Achilles are, but you know, I think you probably would rather have a torn ACL than a torn patellar tendon at this point. James Johnson in Miami, he's had hernia surgery shortly after they were eliminated from the playoffs. So presumably he was playing with that throughout some portion of the end of the year. And then, but you know, that's a 6 to 8 week type of surgery, so shouldn't affect his availability for next year. And PJ Tucker, it was revealed today with their Rockets exit interviews that he played game 7 after getting 3 root canals. Didn't even tell his teammates about it. And then also Tillman Fertitta, we speculated about, you know, his willingness to pay the tax, but I think Maury and Fertitta both spoke today and there seemed to be an indication that they are willing to break the bank to try and keep this team together. So that's certainly a good sign for Houston fans, at least in the short term.
Since we just talked about it and we're actually recording this right now, a little addition to the Detroit Pistons coaching search. Woj is reporting that Miami Heat assistant and deep Michigan connection haver Juwan Howard is going to interview for the job as well.
Well, I like him better than Kenny Smith. All right, one more quick read here, and then we'll talk Boston Celtics offseason. And that read is for a service that you, Danny, have used quite a bit, Stamps.com.
Yeah, I mean, it's different for our business. We do so much through the internet. You know, it's nice. It definitely changes our cost structure and everything else like that. But when you write a book, a book is hard copy, and sure, you can. It is available in Kindle form and ebook form as well. You can buy it that way too if you want. But a lot of my friends and family wanted hard copies, and of course, I went through, you know, and signed and all of that. A lot of different copies of the book, and those all got sent to me by the publisher because that's the way this works. And so that meant I had to send them out myself. And Stamps.com was a great solution to a problem I had never really had to deal with before of how to get a bunch of things out that was both convenient with my schedule, cost effective, and it really delivered. I've been incredibly impressed with really every phase of the process, from scheduling pickups to getting a scale to weigh the packages and getting it out inexpensively.
Yeah, they bring all of the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. They'll even send you a digital scale so you can calculate exact postage. They'll help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. You don't have to lease an expensive postage meter, and there's no long-term commitments at all. Right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer, including a 4-week trial, plus postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in that familiar CapSpace code. Easy to remember, we talk about CapSpace all the time with Ron, especially this time of year as we're doing these off-season previews. That's Stamps.com, enter the code CapSpace, and let them know that you came from us. All right, let's talk about Boston here. We can start with a general idea of their financial picture. Only one major free agent, at least this season, and that is Marcus Smart, who is a restricted free agent. And if they were to bring him back for, say, $13 million, that would put them for next year right about at the tax. So it's difficult to imagine. Maybe if they don't bring back Smart, they could use their full mid-level exception. But I think they probably would want to bring back Smart, and they could even potentially dodge the tax, which I think they probably would be keen to do just because they're going to be likely a tax team for a long time going forward after this year. But maybe they might feel like, oh, we need to add some more players and we're not going to dodge the tax. It would be tough to do it because other than Smart, I mean, there's really nobody on this team. You know, maybe Gershon Yabusele is someone that they could just figure out a way to dump. But other than that, they kind of have this roster set and they need all these guys.
Yeah, the Celtics, I've written about their lack of filler before, and it's a limitation in terms of some of the big trades that they could do. You know, maybe you could make the math work on certain things depending on which young guys they want to include. But it is a real challenge. And those same things are in place in terms of shedding money for the luxury tax, that the guys they want have are the guys they want. And a lot of those players are at reasonable contracts. So it is a real challenge there. And another one that I find particularly compelling, you brought up Marcus Smart, we'll talk about him a little bit too, is Aaron Baines. So Aaron Baines...
Oh yeah, that's right. I did forget about him as another free agent. Sorry.
Yeah. So he is available. They had him, but he's unrestricted and they only have non-bird rights. And so that means that his hold is also the maximum he can make while using that exception, which is about $5.2 million. What's also interesting about that is $5.2 million is almost exactly the same as the amount of the taxpayer mid-level exception, so it's $5.3 million. So if he's not willing to take that for them, whatever duration, I mean, I don't know if they'd want one year, whatever that would be. If he wants more than that, either Boston dips in, they use basically the non-taxpayer mid-level exception, which hard caps them and everything else, like the Rockets did with PJ Tucker, or they just have to let him go. And they can. You know, there are other centers on the market, but I thought Baines did a wonderful job for them this year, and there will be a ton of supply, but I'm not sure there will be anybody who fits it as well as Baines did.
Yeah, certainly Baines, especially with this burgeoning three-point range he's shown, how real that is, remains to be seen. But that makes him a lot more playable on offense. And then defensively, somehow he morphed into one of the better defensive centers in the game. Like, his ability to move his feet in the playoffs was really quite a revelation for me. Despite not being able to really jump, he's got that big chest. He's got good help instincts. And yeah, he gets dunked on all the time, but he also, that's because he's in there protecting the rim. And he also was a panacea for their defensive rebounding problems. Now, he can't finish anything around the rim, but I think certainly he's a guy who they would want to bring back. How many years it would be, you know, because Baines is going to be 31. He came to the NBA pretty late after spending a couple years overseas. What would your offer be to Baines if you were the Celtics? You know, offer more in 1 year? I mean, I think it's a no-brainer to offer him, you know, just the 120%, which would be about $5.2 million, 120% of what he made last year.
Yeah, I would do that. And if he wanted to, maybe do the kind of Milos Teodosic style, give him a player option or some sort of thing for the next year, but maybe not fully guarantee it, maybe $2 million or so of that. I think that would be totally fair and probably be enough to get him to stay.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm not sure who else would be in the market for his services, and he would get some pretty good playing time. They have to get another center. They also got Greg Monroe, who, you know, didn't really seem to work out, especially as a guy in the playoffs. You basically would be bringing him back for essentially the regular season to just soak up some minutes, and I think Monroe would probably be better off going elsewhere. They could pay Monroe actually up to $6 million as well with his non-bird rights, because remember, he got $5 million out of that disabled player exception, which was ended up not being a great investment. I thought he was a disappointment there, but you know, maybe I would offer Baines a 1+1 at that type of money. A lot of it depends too on just how intent they are on dodging the tax, because in 2019, Kyrie Irving, if he's going to be brought back, he's going to get about a $10 million raise. And now there's just, you have no way of avoiding the tax. Horford will be making $30 million that year in the last year of a player option, which he might actually, you could see maybe it'd be possible he opts out of that and they kind of go, you know, Pau Gasol style of like, mm-hmm. give him a longer deal for less annual value. You know, maybe you could see that happening, but that's, you know, we'll see how he plays next year. And then Gordon Hayward will be making $33 million. And also, I think another advantage of bringing back Baines would be having some of that salary fodder that you talked about for potential trades. Although, you know, there really doesn't seem to be anything in the works this offseason the way we might have thought there would be.
And that would be an option for giving him more than 1 year, because if you give him 1 year, then he would have a veto.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. And
Mirotić problem.
Yeah, or maybe it could be something, you know, you mentioned the partial guarantee. So maybe it could be, you know, second year partially guaranteed for like $2 million or something like that.
Sure. But let's talk about the trade possibilities. You got into that. And the challenge, I've nearly written on this about 10 times, the challenge of figuring out any sort of superstar trade is the issue of supply. Because teams that have, you know, the next James Harden trade has to involve a team like Oklahoma City that is willing to trade their James Harden. And it doesn't look like New Orleans is particularly keen on moving Anthony Davis, at least this summer. Kawhi Leonard, you know, that's a conversation we will have in the near future. That will be possible. But remember that if the Celtics were to be interested in Kawhi, they would certainly have the assets. They would have a great pool of assets depending on what they're willing to offer. But I don't think any deal there would happen without some sort of indication from Leonard that he would be willing, or even, you know, as committal as it can be allowed under the rules, to a contract, because otherwise you're not going to pay that for a rental. They already didn't do that for Paul George, and Kawhi is, they're at a much different place now, and the players that would be included in the deal are much more established.
Yeah, and I also think they kind of want to see what they got with this team now, if they can bring back everyone. And certainly the idea of trading Gordon Hayward, I don't think you would have to be in that deal. You know, they could probably, if they put in one of Braun or Tatum in that deal, you know, that's probably the only way it happens. Maybe if it's known that Leonard wants out, that his value just goes down so much that maybe you could do it with like that Memphis pick that they have. And obviously they have that Kings pick that they could trade also. So they have just, I mean, it's preposterous how much ammunition they have still. But, you know, if you were going to rank their assets, it's either Braun or Tatum, 1 and 2, Kings pick, and then Memphis pick probably are, you know, their four premium assets going forward. And I think they would want to avoid giving up either Braun or Tatum in that deal.
And a nice job not getting into the who's better, Braun or Tatum, because, you know, we haven't dealt with that enough this year.
And I still don't really know the answer to that either.
Yeah. And it's also our opinion on it is often different than a GM. And remember, that's the beauty of in the eye of the beholder here, is that, you know, maybe theoretically San Antonio has a strong preference there. Maybe Boston does. Who knows? That's a part of this. But so, yeah, I think it's a possibility, because if Kawhi gets on the market, the Spurs would probably want to move him right away, because the value just diminishes so quick if he's a potential rental, you know, if you get any of the season. There are the injury risk things, so it's possible they just don't get good offers and they hold on to him for that purpose. But outside of Kawhi, you know, there have been these murmurs about Karl Anthony Towns. Of course, if there, you could make an argument like if he were on the market, the Celtics have a bunch of assets, he would be an intriguing fit with their team. Then they wouldn't have to deal with all the financial stuff in terms of the near term. So, yeah, sure. If that comes to pass, it comes to pass. But outside of those guys, I don't see that many game changers that are going to be out there.
Let's turn now to Smart's restricted free agency. He had a comment in the media that he feels like he's worth more than 12 to 14 million. I do not agree with him, particularly in this market. What team is going to offer him more than the full mid-level as a restricted free agent? I really have no idea. And if you're going to offer the full mid-level, you're just not even going to do that anyway, because Boston clearly would match that, both because he's a valuable player for next year. I mean, I do think he is the best defensive guard in basketball, but his offensive limitations are quite pronounced. So, you know, if it were another market, if this were 2016, yeah, he'd be talking about $16 million a year. But not now, and so I'm not sure where this goes. I would say that I don't think it'd be the absolute end of the world if he just takes the qualifying offer from Boston's perspective. Just get him for another year. There's no way that you can have both he and Rozier on the team long-term. Rozier's extension eligible. We'll talk about him in a second. So let me ask you this now, Dan. We've talked about this with a lot of these restricted free agents. What is your offer at the start of restricted free agency to Marcus Smart if you're the Boston Celtics?
So with him, I don't know that I would be... As you know, I don't think getting a fifth year is super valuable with Marcus Smart. Oh, one funny thing about this that I found out when I was researching my piece, Marcus Smart and Terry Rozier are almost exactly the same age. I think they're 2 weeks apart, but because Smart came into the league a little bit earlier, he's 1 year earlier, he's, you know, hitting the market a year earlier. I would probably think about something more in the like 3 years, 35 range would be where I would go. And I know he wouldn't take that, but I think that's where I would go. And then just say, hey, if you want to beat this offer, just do it.
Yeah.
Good luck to you.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you might go for a fourth year, but yeah, I mean, I more than $11 million a year, I don't think I would make that offer, because a big part of getting him is he needs to be tradable on this contract. Like, you can't have a contract that's not tradable. Like, you want him to be of value. And, you know, this is a team that's still probably realistically, I think, needs one more piece potentially. You know, they would still, you'd want to have just one absolute superstar, whether that's AD a year from now, whether that's Kawhi, whether it's whoever the next trade target is. So I think I would hold firm. And then if he wants to take the qualifying offer, he can take the qualifying offer. What about Rozier? I think I've alluded to this. I think his value is never going to be higher than it is right now. He's been making $3 million a year, or $3 million this year, I should say. Then we'll be a restricted free agent. He had a pretty good playoffs, although he fell off quite a bit in that Cleveland series at times. But I think they're probably, if there is a team out there that values him as a potential future starter before he's going to get properly paid, if you could get, you know, a decent first round pick for him right now, I would be all over that. And then that assumes that you can bring back Smart too, because, you know, Kyrie, I doubt they're going to want to play him more than 30 minutes a game. And so they'll need a quality backup point guard option. But I think keeping both Smart and Rozier going into the year is not an optimal use of resources. So I would try to move Rozier. Now, if you can't get much, you can't get that type of an asset for him, okay. But especially when you look at the fact that with their salary structure, keeping him at, you know, starter level of money going forward, especially when he's not going to be a starter, your starter is probably Kyrie Irving, doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense. Sell high on him would be an optimal strategy if that offer is available.
I agree with you, and on the basic premise for me is a little bit different for it. I mean, the value part is certainly a consideration. It is this. If Kyrie, for what presumably health reasons, though, I mean, he will be an unrestricted free agent, so he can go wherever the hell he wants. If Kyrie were to leave or not be the player that he is, would Terry Rozier be capable of stepping in and being the starter, even if it's the fifth starter, on a championship team? And for me, the answer to that is no. I think it's asking too much of in terms of shot creation from everybody else. They do have some players that are capable of that. And remember that Boston's window is a little bit weird here, because they have players like Al Horford who are better now than they're going to be in a couple of years. And then they have players like Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown who will be presumably better in 3 to 4 years. But that's why the question matters, is because if Rozier can't shoulder that burden, even if they pay him backup money, it just gets really complicated for the Celtics. And he's not going to, you know, presumably he's not going to be on a real value contract. He's probably going to be properly paid or close to it. So if that's what you're looking at, trade him. See if somebody values him more highly than that. And if you do think that he can be that player, try to extend him, because then you can lock that in and he can get a lot of risk mitigation out of it.
Yeah, I think he's a good defender and he gets out in transition and he's really improved as far as making spot up shots. So I think you could get enough with Hayward, Brown, Tatum, and then Al Horford obviously is a great playmaker also, if for some reason Kyrie were to go down or have to be traded himself. But that said, I don't see him as like a premium talent, and if there's a team out there that really values him that way. Now, who might that team be? You could say I think he would be a pretty nice fit in Indiana. I think he would be a pretty good fit in Phoenix. You know, you don't want him as the lead dog, but kind of playing that George Hill sort of role, isn't quite of the size of George Hill, but teams that have a guard who can do a lot of the creation, he could play off of that guy pretty well, I think.
I don't think this would be the right move for them now, because I think Utah needs more information, but the Jazz could be another option if they think he fits next to Donovan Mitchell. Be pretty interesting.
Yeah. There are teams that could use him now, whether those teams have the ammo. I mean, Phoenix, certainly, for example, think of all the extra draft picks that they have. And obviously, Ryan McDonough has a connection with the Celtics organization, so they have a good relationship to make a trade work there. So you could see with those picks that Phoenix has, and there might be some Celtics.
Well, yeah. and Phoenix's arsenal of young guys, yeah. But Danny Ainge could feel like they can get something out of Bender or Chris or any number of guys that maybe Phoenix hasn't.
I would
yet.
Imagine they would prefer future draft picks because they just want to kick the can as far down the road as possible, both in terms of having them as assets and assets that don't count anything against the cap. I really think that we'll see how much Smart ends up getting. But if they could just move Rozier and just dump that $3 million as well and get a future draft pick, that would be useful just to avoid the tax this year. I mean, when you're looking at a long period of contention and going into the tax ahead of you, being able to get out of the tax this year is really helpful. I think more likely than not, they probably end up paying it because they'll want to use the mini mid-level as well. And I think a lot of Celtics fans say, you know what, Rozier, he's so good. Like, just giving him up for just a mid-first-round pick, like, you know, the odds are with a mid-first-round pick, you don't draft someone as good as Terry Rozier. That's true. But you really have to think of Terry Rozier as Terry Rozier on a $17 million a year contract after next year. And now how much is he worth? You know, that's how you have to kind of think about it. And those players tend to be kind of, all right, he's an okay starter, but he's not going to be a value on his contract. And those type of players get first-round picks. Maybe it could be a little bit more than that. Maybe it could be a young prospect as well, or you could throw some seconds in or whatever to equalize the value. But I think once it got, you know, I wouldn't do it for the number 25 overall pick or a pick that projected to be there, but you know, that's pretty much it. So real quickly, I know you got to go here. Anyone you would be targeting with the mini mid-level exception if you're them?
Well, I mean, the most obvious thing would be if Baines left, they would need a center. Yeah. But I would say what they should try to look for the taxpayer MLE would be floor spacing. I would be very interested in somebody. I mean, there are a couple different ways you could do that. So if you want to go more at the three, Joe Harris is a possibility there. I don't love that fit. I also thought about a Gerald Green return as a possibility. Just maybe Boston can get him in a place like Houston did where it's a, you know, execute defensively, hit open shots. I also thought about going a little bit more to the four, Tolliver, Ilyasova, Mike Scott. And then if Brad Stevens is an actual coaching wizard, Omri Caspi for the minimum would be fascinating. Like this, like maybe he can do what Steve Kerr could not and actually get him to take threes, because Caspi at the minimum would actually be a decent fit with their team.
What you need with the mini mid-level to me is about what you perceive your team needs to be. And also, are you trying to get out of the East or are you trying to win a championship? Because if you're trying to get out of the East, I think Wayne Ellington would be a guy who would really help them, right? Now, his market might actually be higher than the mini mid-level, although if they went for more years, then that could change. But he's a guy, you know, they just need one absolute dead bang knockdown shooter. You know, they someone who can help them avoid those droughts like they had in game 7. Because they have a lot of, like, pretty good three-point shooters. But nobody is just like, oh my God, we just could not leave this dude. You know, other than maybe Kyrie at this point. But can Wayne Ellington play that much in a series against the Warriors? You know, maybe not. Or against Houston, if it's Houston. Or depending where LeBron ends up. But especially for the regular season and, you know, against a team like the Sixers or something like that, I think someone who shoots the ball like him would be who you might want to go to. I mean, I don't think this is the one team that doesn't need kind of more 3-and-D type of wing players. You know, they could also maybe, they don't have many needs other than that. Like, one more versatile big would be nice too. We've said Noah Vonleh a lot. He's a guy who I think, you know, would fit into kind of what they're trying to do maybe as well. But yeah, all right, I think that's about it. Anything else you want to say on these guys before we get going here?
I just want to mention the assets that they have beyond their own picks moving forward just briefly. Yeah. They have the better of the Kings and Sixers pick, unless it is number one next season. Memphis's first is protected 1-8 in 2019, 1-6 in 2020, and unprotected in 21. And then they have the Clippers first, which is lottery protected in 2019 and 2020, and then would go into second rounders, I believe, if it doesn't go in. So those are really high-end assets beyond all these players they have that have been so successful. So if an opportunity presents itself, Boston just has, they have more assets than they know what to do with. And remember, they traded, among other things, they traded what ended up becoming the 8th overall pick for Kyrie Irving. So it's incredible the asset base that Danny Ainge has built, and we'll see how they use it.
Yeah, and really, unless you can get a guy who's a top 5 superstar, especially with how expensive this team is going to be going forward, maybe you just hold on to all those picks and just use them to continue to infuse young talent, especially given how well Brad Stevens has been able to develop these guys and how well they've drafted. You know, those picks might be worth more to them than to anyone else. So thanks again for listening. Thanks again to Sonos for sponsoring today's program. With the Sonos, you can control music with your voice. You can even have someone set up your Sonos speakers for free if you live in any major metropolitan area. Just order from Sonos.com, select up and running at checkout, and you may get 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com when you use the promo code DUNK10. That's DUNC10. Different code this time, DUNK10, DUNC10. It's offer available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions.